So QEMU is an emulator, a binary translator. It reads portions of binary executables and then translates those into some architecture, let's say x86. And by doing that, you can emulate any architecture because you can translate any code architecture to any other code architecture. And what we are doing is that in the translation point, we have many instructions, right? So we are doing it for x86. In this case, we have loads and stores, which are memory accesses. So for each load and store, we, instead of just creating the final binary with the translation of a load and a store only, we add the load plus some code to write whatever we are loading into disk, just trace it, and for stores the same. So in that fashion, we are just tracing every load and store instruction that's coming to the translation. And that's basically what we're doing. And the issue there is, the first issue is with timing, because first you had a bunch of instructions, right? And you are translating these instructions to another architecture. It can be even the same, but because you are extending the stream of instructions with the tracing, this time will take longer than this is the original time. So we took care of this first by measuring the time we took in tracing and removing that time. But that's incorrect because we are messing with the caches, and also the timing is not correct. We tried something with CPI, which is basically trying to measure the amount of instructions that you have and multiplying these by some constant, which is the cycles per instruction. Let's say every instruction in average takes 10 cycles. So you just multiply and you have an idea of CPU cycles, that's time for us. But that didn't work also.
Why?
We don't know. I mean, it's just an average, it's very approximated. Right? But the approximation was just too bad. I mean, the times we were having compared to the real times were, I don't know how bad, but
there were
not zero percentage, there were X's.
Yeah, and there were cases where I remember that between two accesses, it was just simply too small. I mean, you cannot have two consequent access in that small amount of time because accessing memory takes longer than that. So there were some consistency problems there. And there were also cases where we have huge gaps. There were problems also there.
So there is one part which you missed, which is about the simulation of the caches.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, that's another thing. Is that, you know, we get all the instructions from the virtual machine. It's really a virtual machine. We get all possible access coming through here to this emulated hardware. So in order to have a realistic timing, we need to simulate a cache here.
No, wait. So the reason we needed a cache was not because of the time. The reason was because we needed only the accesses to memory. And because the thing is that when we are tracing all the instructions, there are a lot of accesses to memory that won't go actually to memory, but will be will go to the cache, right? So
But we might want to have all access to L1 cache. That's not the issue. We were concerned about RAM accesses just for our project.
No,
we might want to have all.
Oh, you're talking about the time to log all the.
I'm talking about we use this cache idea as another way of reducing the time errors.
The first
use of the caches was just that, you know, to have all the accesses after RAM, because with the simulator only we cannot have that. We have in every single load and store, but need a simulator of a cache to know what's going.
Besides, there was also another problem. I mean, if we log all every single memory access.
It's huge, but it will take one.
It, first, it's huge, and it will take the whole disk, right?
But that's not the issue. I mean, we have traces after L1, for example. We have those.
Yeah.
We have those. But the thing is that another idea we tried for more precise timings was that most of the time of execution before going to disk is taken in F2 cache matrix. So we were trying to to take into account the time plus KPIs by measuring the amount of misses of RAM accesses, and by having the time and average RAM access takes, you can just add it up to the CPI based time and have a more realistic time. I don't know if that's clear.
So going back to this cache simulator, the reason we had the cache simulator, first of all, was because we wanted to filter out accesses that would be satisfied from the cache. And we were only concerned with memory accesses. That was the primary reason for this cache to be included, but it has other benefits, I agree. The other issue which is related here is that our cache simulator is not perfect.
Yes.
It's an approximation of what the system would do.
Yes.
Although we chose the configuration of the cache that the cache simulator simulates very carefully, map it very well to the machine and so on, it's still an approximation.
Yeah.
Which is why we see the errors in the timing based on a coarse granularity CPI scaling.
Yes.
Right? Because if we miss cache access and think that it is a memory access, those cache axes can be really close together. And if you apply the uniform CPI scaling factor, they will come really close together, even in memory time. And that's why I think we encountered situations where we have two memory axes that are just too close, because they are probably cache axes, right? Or maybe one is a memory axis and followed by a cache axis, or vice versa. Mm.
That made me think that probably one useful thing about this is that I don't know how currently architecture people evaluate new replacement algorithms for caches, CPU caches, for instance. But this could be one way to do it, right? I mean, you can pretty much plug in any kind of cache you want there, which, of course, you cannot do with a CPU, right?
Just for the CPU caches.
I'm talking about the CPU caches.
Yes. I think QMU is probably also used by some researchers for that, right?
Yeah, could
be. For simulating CPU caches.
Yeah.
So one possible solution would be to have a more realistic cache simulator,
which mimics what the hardware does.
Yeah.
Very carefully, which is certainly one direction.
Another, which is the one I liked a lot, was that we thought that we have L2 misses versus time. Let's say for the execution of a workload, you have in a physical machine, let's say you have something like this. And let's say in our execution, we have something like this. So the thing is that this is real, it's ours. So what I think is happening is that the real time our time is being stretched out uniformly or compressed uniformly. So if we find these like signatures in our traces compared to these, we can find a uniform constant to stretch or compress the traces.
Actually, we can. I mean, it doesn't have to be constant, right? We can.
Even if it's not constant, but it could be constant in some period.
In some period,
yes.
Exactly. So we can do something fancier, where we compress different parts of the trace with a different ratio depending on the signature that we have in the real machine.
So the idea with this would be that you first run the application in a physical machine and get this easily with no cost. And then you run our stuff, the simulator, and you also get this, and then you find a factor for periods or whatever, and you fix the traces. I mean, that's the option I was more confident in, but we were not able to, you know, to implement.
So one thing I want to say is that I see the problem of time just as a, the question is what kind of paper we want to present. I feel there are several projects here. For instance, we need to solve the time problem only if we want to provide traces that are to be replayed somehow, right? But even if we don't have the time part...
No, wait a minute, that's not true. We need timing accurate traces for many different things, and we can talk about that.
Yeah,
one
yeah.
of those is replay.
So you're saying we have recuperation or illustration?
No, what I'm saying is that there could be other opportunities. I mean, even if we don't have the time part, there may be some other things we can do with what we have right now. I don't know, some kind of analysis or whatever, right? That we can also explore without solving the time issue.
And that goes to the other part of this project, which we liked a lot. You know, the thing is that you have your OS on the VM, and you have here the tracing and everything, but you have traces after this level. You don't know anything about the OS. So something we wanted, for example, was to know whether a memory access was going to the buffer cache or was going to some portion of RAM of the OS. You know? To enrich the traces with information from the OS. So we had some basic code that just, I mean, from the OS, there are ways where you can export data structures to QEmu.
Via hypercore, I guess.
Oh, that's a one way. Another, but that's very expensive. But one other way is to just get the, you know, you have the map of symbols of the OS. So if this is mapped to specific address and you have the map of symbols, you just add this offset with the map of symbols and you can just access OS structures directly. Event functions. So
we doing a function call then, the system call then.
It's not even a system call, it's just jump into this instruction.
Whoa.
We have that.
Not instruction.
Or if you want to read some portion of memory, you just read. Just add this offset and read.
You mean that QEmu reads the map?
Reads maps and data structures from the OS so it can enrich the trace. The simple test I did was just a global variable here, and that global variable is exported in the mapping of the symbols of the OS, and reading and writing from here. That works. So if that works, it means you can extend.
No, but you said, I remember that actually, that works sometimes.
That works some. That was most of the time. For some reason, during some phases, it doesn't work. I don't know what those phases are.
What do you mean by it doesn't work?
You read garbage.
Okay. But
it was
a mess
before
with the state of the OS.
No, well, hopefully, but this will be read only for QEmu.
And that global variable doesn't matter to the kernel.
Yeah.
Is that something that he created?
Yeah. But ideally, it would be some
not used by the kernel
of pages by the kernel or something which you can work.
What? A pointer? You mean?
Yeah. Well, it could be whatever, right?
Yeah. We don't know if that the messing up of the variable or the variable does get messed up or not, because that variable is a non-critical variable. Even if it gets messed up, the kernel probably still executes.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
I guess the idea will be half a point to a real structure and then...
Yes. And even further, the idea is to have a framework which can be used by any developer or whatever of a guy that's using these traces. So you can instrument any call and add it to somehow to these traces. A more generic kind of framework.
One of the problems with that approach was that it was not general for any operating system, right?
It will be kernel. It will be
Linux.
But that's fine. That's useful enough.
Yeah, I think that's good enough. As long as you can show that there is utility.
Yeah.
Why is not for any kernel?
The thing is that now, I mean, we will depend on the symbol table, right? Which
could be available.
Yeah, it's like for the virtualization, right? You need to modify each different kernel to provide that.
No, I mean, one approach might be to, you know, to provide a nice interface from here to this guy, but it can be done even simpler. With knowledge of this code, you can get whatever from this code that you want. But that's up to you. You can add a nice interface which you could add from any OS or something like that.
Okay, so that's nice. I mean, all of this sounds very interesting, but I think we also have we wrapped up, first of all, the discussion about the current state of this tracing.
Oh, yeah.
Is that over?
Yeah, the tracing is, we know, I mean, are we sure that the tracing is okay except the timing? Everything is right?
Everything is right.
The issue that I remember is that we didn't do DMA.
That's one of the
issues. That's one issue.
Yeah.
Right, so we weren't able to trace the DMA rights.
Yeah,
right.
But
why it's not a load or store?
No.
The DMA, the controller of the disk, let's say, DMA is also in the network, but in the controller of the disk, part of the driver, I mean, when you issue an I/O, the driver tell the
disk where
the disk, the disk controller where to write in memory.
But that part you need to do it. The CPU needs to do it.
No.
No, I mean, the part where the driver tells.
Yeah, but that doesn't have any load or store, right? It's just an issue of the
it's an in-out
instruction.
Yeah, but in QEMU, the controller is just a piece of code that's like writing and reading into memory, so you can also instrumentate that.
Exactly, because QEMU is exporting a disk controller,
which is not an actual piece of hardware, it's just software, which you will have to instrument as well.
So in that way, QEMU will be the one that is generating the traces of that part,
not the
kernel.
Yes.
For instance, you won't see, in these traces, you won't see the prefetching reads.
Yes, you won't.
You won't see them.
The
prefetching reads.
What's prefetching? The cache? The CPU cache?
There's not prefetching.
No, file system prefetching, for instance. You won't see it.
Oh, you won't see it.
Why?
You won't see it.
No, you won't see it
because it's pure DMA.
It's
pure DMA.
Okay.
So only if those pages do get accessed eventually will you see that data or will you see those pages being referenced.
Okay.
So in terms of accuracy, for memory access traces are sort of accurate to the extent of accesses coming from CPU, but not directly coming from devices.
But
even before that, do we capture all CPU accesses? So you talked about load and store, but I think x86 has a whole bunch of other instructions.
You have a
general load and store.
Architecture, and you have a general language.
Okay.
And then you have the final architecture.
Okay.
So we are translating on the general language.
And that only has loads
load
and store for
a very simple language, and that's the beauty
of it. Yeah. But
okay.
I got last. Why do you need the DMA if you're tracing memory access, not disk access?
The thing is that,
if you wrote something from the disk to the memory, you don't care until you access it, right?
Depends on the application, what you're going to use the traces for. In some cases, it may not be necessary. But for what we were doing, it was necessary because we wanted to look at memory power consumption. And any type of access, CPU or DMA, would contribute to the power consumption of memory. Right. But it would also matter probably in other, for instance, if you're measuring memory bandwidth requirement. If you miss out on the DMA bandwidth requirement, you may miss on a significant portion of the memory bandwidth requirement.
And something very important about this is that, I mean, all of this is done in something called full system simulators, which are just virtual machines that simulate every single bus, every single cache, and everything of the machine. But those are amazingly slow. So the only, I mean, gain of doing all of this stuff is because we can do this without slowing down the applications too much. So the challenge about all of this is that we have to add all of this stuff without making it too slow. So that's really the main issue we have. The trick is, I mean, the key is to make it fast. For example, for these callings, this passage, I mean, it cannot be a hypercall or something fancy. It needs to be extremely fast. Because if for every single load and store you do something like a hypercall, which will extend into thousands of cycles, it will be slow again and it's not worth it.
So Ricardo, that general language up there would also include these DMA calls, right? So we should be able to instrument for DMA even in the same general language as well.
We could. You mean to reuse code?
No, I mean just to make sure that we're not making changes in multiple places. So if we, let's say in the future, decide to also monitor all DMA calls, then we could do it in that general language, right? Or does it not?
Well, not really, because the DMA calls are made by some software that doesn't go to translation.
Okay, yeah, that was my question, right?
Yeah, it doesn't go to translation. It doesn't have to, at least.
But it's still
basically that code that you compile that you can make generate whatever tracing you want.
But when the kernel issues the DMA, it needs to go through that process, right?
Yes, it will. But this is not translate. This is not code that you have to translate.
But I mean, eventually what you run is that final piece of code there, right?
Oh, okay.
This.
No, the final. Okay.
Below that.
Final.
Ah, the final. Yes.
That's
yes.
What you run.
This is put into memory and it jumps and executes.
Right, and that execution will also include programming of the DMA controller.
No. The thing is that, hold on.
If that's what executes, how
this
you...
This is a front end, right? So the front end will, in our case, will take care of x86 instructions. There is a huge switch case, by the way, so that covers all instructions that x86 has. What would happen is that when an in-out instruction comes, it will go to that switch, and instead of generating the middle, the general code, it will go to a code that is a driver, a controller simulator, right, of, I don't know, some kind of SATA or SCSI or whatever, and that SCSI will generate an I/O.
But where does that add it to the instruction stream for the final? Because it's a final.
One way I think it could be done is that this is a process and this is another process.
Another process?
It could, because Jim runs a lot of processes. So maybe it's another process.
No, but I
don't. Or another way, which is what Luis is telling, is that, I mean, from these, at this point in translation, you can call any function, right?
Okay.
You just call a function that does the work of the driver, and then you will translate and execute. And between translations and executions, you can just execute drivers and...
I think we need to understand that control flow better.
Yes, that would be something else. Yes.
Okay, so that part is missing. The timing is a problem.
So one is the DMA, and understanding how the driver, how it works.
Yeah, how it works and whether we can trace it or not.
Second is the timing.
Right.
And you have this and this. I don't know if we have any other right?
So for the DMA, it's program and then also what about the interruptions? And how do those work? I mean the completions and
how the interaction works here?
Yeah. I mean, so let's say you program for DMA and the DMA is executed.
Yeah, well, interaction works by every translation and execution is done in pieces. So after executing every piece, this guy checks whether there is a pending interrupt. If there is a pending interrupt, it checks what's the vector and then goes and loads that portion of the interrupt in the device.
Right. So the reason I'm asking is because then we... For tracing the DMA accurately, we would need information about when the DMA was initiated and when it got completed, things of that kind.
Yeah,
so we know when memory got accessed.
Yeah. And pretty much is all that you need, right? With that and the bus of the device.
I'm not completely clear. I'm not sure if that's very easy to do.
What?
The DMA part.
But what I mean, the information that you need is when you issue the DMA and when it's complete.
Yeah. Right, so
you don't need the issue, right? You just need the... the problem is that between the issue and the completion, the access to memory could happen at any time, right? My point is that we don't really have the exact time where the DMA access happens.
Yeah. Yeah, we need to understand that method. Okay. Then.
So I think with this we have our faith, right? I mean, if we're able to do all of this and we show that faster than food system simulation and we show some examples of motivation, that's our faith, really. I think that's a very useful piece of work.
Yeah, I agree it would be useful. We have to go through the literature survey to see what people have done in this direction.
Yeah.
And we haven't really done that.
No. Well, that's another point.
Yeah, we should probably do that as number one. They review the literature to see what exists before we say that this is going to be a research project.
So something we saw here was, first food system simulation, and then some guys did tracing at hardware level. On the bus, they had some circuit that actually dumped stuff into memory, dumped traces.
To the same memory or?
To another memory. Well, it doesn't do paper, whatever. They just dump it. Yeah. But clearly we cannot compete with that. And that's not useful.
We have to write about it.
And
discuss how a software only solution is better. Or better in some cases.
Yeah.
But there may be other software-only solutions.
Yes.
And that, for that, we have to do a full literature review.
Yeah. So what do you think?
Okay. So that for that paper, the only missing piece is the motivation. I mean, the contributions or the technical aspect of it is there. It's sufficiently interesting, but what is the motivation, right? For any paper, we have to discuss that.
Let's say we mention our stuff, our papers, which we use.
Yes, that's good. But it would be nice to have a more broader discussion on the motivation itself. What are the different classes of things that people could do if they had full system, timing accurate memory traces?
Yeah.
So we need ideas for that. We have some things in our lab that we do that can use this. We haven't really thought more broadly about how this could be used.
So I agree. I think we should just start with reviewing literature, see what solutions are available right now.
Yes. It's possible that someone else has had similar goals and made some progress. Right? Maybe not with QMU, maybe with something similar. So we need to go and find out what exists.
So I guess What did you think of the structures that would be interesting to access from QM. Because maybe that
gives us
motivation.
Well, one was to know whether what's the page you're accessing? If it's a OS user, buffer, what is? I mean, maybe we can get nice stats from all of these pages which we can publish by itself. Let's say we get some very interesting information about DMA accesses which nobody noticed before. I don't know.
For instance, our pages, how frequently are read-only pages accessed versus read-write?
Yeah.
That could indicate some direction for new memory page replacement algorithms.
Exactly.
Yeah. So far, really, all the code that you guys have has been in QEMU, basically printing and the result of that translation in the general language.
No, it's just dump. Yeah, well, at this level, dumping loads and stores. Plus, I mean, at this level, you have loads and stores in virtual memory, mm-hmm. but you want it actual physical memory. So that's another translation we do. Just that, and then trying lots of different things for fixing times, and none of them work. So
we have more than that. I mean, we have the virtual address, we have the physical address, the way
read write
in the page table
was, no, it was kind of the page table. The thing is that QEMU inside has a TLB, a software TLB, so we use that. But we also were dumping a lot of information from the page table entry for that page. I remember that we dumped CR3.
How do you access the... Oh,
you are here in Simulated Harvest, you have access everything here in the hardware.
But the page table is in memory.
Right.
Yeah, but it can be accessed, but it has to be managed by this.
You are the machine, right? So you can access whatever you want.
If you know where the CR3 is, you know where the page table is in memory, you can directly read from that.
But then you read information from memory without problem.
I don't know. That's fine. You can read whatever you want here, but you need some meaning, right? You need to know where the structure for something is and read it. So.
Yeah, no, I was wondering because you said that with the variable sometimes works, sometimes...
Oh, well, that means that the mapping is changing sometimes or something.
Oh, okay.
Right, it's moving, the memory address is changing, you don't know about it.
But this mapping is using virtual addresses, right?
Yes.
And you're reading using physical address or not?
The physical address of QEMU, which would be a virtual address for your real machine.
Yeah. And as long as that's what you need, right?
That's
you need the virtual address.
Right.
So why would it work sometimes and not always?
Because probably the page table is changing. I mean, if you have probably the kernel is doing some mapping or a mapping, reusing that mapping for something else. The thing is that you cannot access the physical memory of the virtual machine. You have to access the virtual memory of the virtual machine.
Well, that's what.
Yeah, but the thing is that you have to do the translation through the page table of the virtual machine.
Yes, you're doing that. Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
Yes. Otherwise, I wouldn't catch it the first time.
Catch it the first time.
I wouldn't be able to read at least, not even once.
I don't know.
You will have to be extremely lucky to just go to one byte and.
I don't know how the page, the kernel maps the page. Probably there are some parts of the kernel which is mapped one to one.
Probably, yeah.
Oh, okay. I was thinking.
Yeah, we need more. Some more ideas on motivation and applications of this. I think if we can all think in that direction, it would be very useful. Think about what are the various applications of full system, timing accurate memory traces.
You mentioned that we already have some traces, right?
Yeah,
we do.
How confident are you about the accuracy of those traces?
we did some basic tests with very simple programs which we know, for which we know the patterns and everything of memory, and that was okay.
Right.
Very simple tests.
And you haven't done any analysis on these treasures yet?
We use them for many projects.
Yeah, but there was, well, yeah, we did some analysis.
Yeah.
And the result of this analysis, I'm assuming, was consistent
with what we thought was there. So,
well,
yeah.
Not really. I mean, we didn't really know what was going on. We just thought the traces are good and we used the traces assuming that it's good.
Yeah, but for example, we did stuff like we created programs that could work in sets with a specific size, and then we, with the traces, we created MRCs and stuff like that, and we saw that the working set sizes matched. Or we did tests, for example, programs that follow a pattern, specific pattern in reads and writes and in memory or whatever, and we check the traces and it's actually following the pattern.
I didn't know that. Okay. Well, that's good.
Yeah, that's a very good thing.
But that's just for locations. Timing, we know for sure we're wrong. But we don't know if we are uniformly stretched or, you know, this stuff.
I mean, the instructions that you add to print to dump the information is adding new cycles, new instructions. And that introduces a delay, which is significant for memory.
Yeah, but I mean, that delay we can measure and we can reduce it from the timings. But that's not the main issue. The main issue is that because you have something executing and you have tracing code being executed, this tracing code is just messing up with caches, and then you have a cache which is not, you have like a context switch in the middle of every execution.
And you are messing up with the execution of the application and also with that piece of code that sometimes
yes,
and miss sometimes.
The better way to measure time would be somehow counting cycles, right?
But it's the same thing, right?
Yeah,
because if you can distinguish between the cycles that are used to for real execution and the cycles that are
but you don't know about you know about instructions. You can count instructions, but you don't know how many cycles this instruction will take.
But you can find that out, right?
But even
how? But some instructions you know exactly how many cycles it would take. Some other instructions that varies.
No, pretty
much in X86 pretty much everything varies. You have this pipeline thing, you know, with for which instruction can be delayed, can be shorted, we can
the same instruction can take different amounts of time.
Even worse, exactly. Yes.
Right? Because if you access memory, you could either access it from cache and there are different levels, or you could access it from memory. So there is like 1,000 order of magnitude difference.
But even knowing how many cycles, that doesn't work if you're messing up with the cache. By tracing, you are already changing the times of the application.
That's the challenge. Yeah, I think that's the challenge we have. So the suggestion that Ricardo has to look at MRCs and then adjust our times based on that.
Well, it's not MRC, it's something versus
not MRC, sorry.
It could be misses or some signature of the workload versus time.
Have you guys tried partitioning the cache in QEMU and then somehow force that your instructions are in this side of the, in this partition of the cache and your instructions?
Something I tried was I tried in a machine with two processors, with two cores, one core doing the tracing, so I was assuming the tracing is going to level one cache of this core, and core one was doing pretty much all the execution, but that didn't work either.
But to be in the level one needs to be also in the level two, right?
But I don't see, I mean, how is the cache of the host machine relevant?
For timing.
What do you mean?
It would be relevant for the timing.
How?
Because the timings would change if you mess with the cache.
But the time is virtual, right? I mean, there are many things happening inside QEMU that we would have to count them. I mean, the only thing that is happening in QEMU is not only tracing. There are a bunch of things happening.
But remember what we did, right? I mean, you have execution of a nice piece of code, tracing, code, translation, tracing, blah, blah, and we were discounting all of these tracing and translation times.
But I guess your point is that even QM will change the times, but
yes.
That's true, I guess.
That's true. That's the delay application suffer in QM.
Okay, so, well, the first thing is that if we are discounting this, then we don't need to, I mean, the tracing doesn't matter, right?
What do you mean, the tracing?
The times.
Because the tracing is happening here, the tracing is not happening here.
Exactly, yes.
Okay, so if we are subtracting this time from the, I mean, if we're only adding up these times, then...
it should be correct, but it's not, because... In reality, you wouldn't have these guys,
yes.
But because these guys are running and messing up with caches, TLDs, and everything.
Right,
but
that's what I'm suggesting is there's a way to partition the cache and make sure that goes to a different partition of the cache, that way you don't mess with the cache.
Yeah, that's what I tried with putting a different core, and it wasn't enough. So.
But the thing is that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's not enough. It's because what is running is right here. It's not only tracing. There are a bunch of things happening.
Yeah, but it's
so
fine.
That,
we are measuring all of that as well.
Right, but all that things happening are also messing up with the L1.
Yes, but our tracing is happening much frequently than those. Remember that the translation blocks were a couple of hundred of Ks, right? Or something like that. Wait, I think it was 100 Ks. So that means that 100 Ks of... translated code was running uninterrupted, but now we have interruptions every single load and store.
Okay. So that's my other question. If QM is already inserting noise,
but that noise was every deep.
Yeah, but is it good for memory tracing or?
But we have to find out a way to first eliminate what the noise we are introducing. And then if we are successful, then the next bottleneck would be to eliminate the noise that QMU is introducing.
Or
both of these are real problems.
Yeah, but that QMU noise
because
was small enough for us to consider QMU.
Because running applications like QMU is already different from running...
Exactly, but it's not much different.
But we don't really have to reduce that, right? As long as we... If it's fast enough and we're able to identify it, then we're fine, because then we can... make it out of our analysis. The problem with the tracing is that it uses too much time.
Yes.
So
but
how much, wait, give us a sense
time.
For how much, it,
it's
how much time it takes to
right.
How much time it takes to run the code without tracing versus not? With QMU.
I think it was with QMU without tracing.
With QMU without tracing and with QMU with tracing.
With QMU with tracing we have 2x or something like that.
I don't remember.
Really good.
Yeah. I mean, it's you know, the time was the time I was taking the most was dumping stuff on this. But we have a very large simulated cache and we dump to this very unfrequently. We had very good time. It was 2x or something like that. And QMU without tracing, it was really, really, really fast.
But it was fast because you were not tracing anything, if everything was a hit in the cache.
Yes, but still you have to simulate the cache. You have to run code every single load and store.
Okay.
So maybe that code wasn't really messing up the cache all that much. I mean, if it's equivalent in time, performance, then could we also say that the, its effect on the cache effectiveness is not much, it's not significant?
Well, no, but that's what, that those were the cases 2x or something. We have much more cases, we have 10x or something like that.
Yeah, because the thing about it, depending on well, how much hits you have in the cache. If you have many hits in the cache, in the simulated cache, right, then
right.
You don't have to go to this. How many accesses do you have? If you have many accesses, then you are more likely to miss the cache, so you go to this.
It depends on how the application.
No, you have to go to this because every access in memory means a new entry in our log.
But
a
log is synced with every access, or there are
no,
there
is
many buffers.
Yeah. I think right now it's all buffer. I mean,
yeah.
There is the, you know, the file interface of Unix. It's buffered, So I remember that what I did was to use that interface, and it has a call that increments the default size of that buffer, and that's what I use. And I think that that did a pretty good job, right?
But do you mean by buffering? If you're writing to a page in the file system, you're writing to a page in
the... You don't sync every write. You sync every... whenever you fill up your buffer.
Oh, you mean how many pages of file system are in memory? That's what you increase.
Yeah, the other thing I did, I remember, was to... because printing ASCII was just too much. I mean, having ASCII was too big. So what I did was to print binary. And then I developed a tool that created an ASCII or did even it did statistics over the binary traces. And that was better as well.
As opposed to translate them to ASCII and then do analysis over ASCII?
Yeah.
And what is the size of those traces?
There were
gigas.
Yeah, there were, but there were not many gigas. I mean, there were no 100 gigas.
Oh, no.
There was, I don't know, 10 gigs max.
We traced applications that run for 10 seconds.
Yeah.
10 seconds.
Very small.
Yeah.
So, do you have an idea of how much the factor, like how much memory is used, read, or written, and then the data that you, the amount of data that you generate, how much bigger it is compared to them?
Well, usually, on a net to cache, you have a 99% of heat, so that's the fact.
But it means that for every mini operation, the vector that you generate, how big it is?
Oh, you mean how much data we have to dump per store, and what you need 32 bits per access, I mean per address, you have virtual, you have physical, you have timing depends how many bytes you're going to give it. I don't know.
So it's big.
It could be big, yeah. But that's not the issue. You can't even compress that.
So you were tracing just memory access or L2 access as well?
For some projects, we traced L2 access as well. In some projects, we did L2 cache, modeling and stuff like that. So we needed access to L2 cache.
What about this machine multiple with L2?
Well, you can simulate whatever cache you want.
Oh, because, of course, the CPU is not similar.
Yeah.
So the cache simulator was something that was added on to the QME, right?
Yeah. And we borrowed that code from a project called Valgrind.
Yeah, the thing is that QEMU original doesn't need a cache, right?
Because it uses a machine's cache.
It actually, I mean, the accesses go to the
machine.
To the machine, so.
Yeah.
Why would Balgrind use a cache?
What?
Balgrind, you said?
Yeah.
It's used to track memory accesses and value memory accesses and things like that.
Yes, but just application accesses.
Right, so why would I use a cache?
A simulator.
It uses a simulator. It doesn't have to, but if you want to get statistics from a cache, and you want more statistics than the processor can provide you, you need to pass all the instructions through simulator. And that's what Valgrind does.
I thought it was only a debugging tool as opposed to a probing tool.
As opposed to what?
Probing tool, to probe. Yeah.
Oh, well, it does a lot of stuff. You can add plugins to Valgrind. One of the plugins is a cache simulator.
That's it.
Okay, literature review. Let's start with that. And then we can...
So what do you guys... How do you guys find letter work?
What is the work?
Memory.
Google Scholar. Yeah, memory tracing, memory analysis, cache simulation.
Would it be better that one person does the search and then distribute the results to each of us, like distribute them, as opposed to everybody doing independent search.
I think everyone will end up with something different.
But if it's the same database, like Google Scholar?
It would be good for us to not read the same paper
right
at once, right? Two times.
So in
that sense, we could have a database of papers that we think are relevant, put that somewhere so that people can and assign people to read, and then that would be better distribution of time.
Okay.
Maybe we can start with that. So if we can do that in the coming week or 2 weeks, then we can meet after that. Decide what we want to do.
So, is there any problem that I use that for the architecture class or not?
You're forced to.
Yeah.
Isn't that too big for your class?
No, well, I guess I should use just one subset. Something like trying to establish the communication where you left, or just one problem, not everything.
Yeah, sure.
Find something to work on.
Sure. So both of you are interested in this, right?
I am.
Okay. Since you are too.
Yeah.
Okay. It's good. So you get to work together.
When can we schedule some sort of code review?
I guess we can go through the code on Tuesday.
Tuesday
afternoon?
Yeah, I don't really have to be there, but you guys can do it. We have, projector.
We have
NPM
for the
QM. We have Git. The reason it was Git is because the original repository of QM is Git.
Okay.
So I keep it that way.
So my Git. Is there,
yeah, so exactly. So my point was that you can merge from the, pull from the original Git repository in case we need something, some new feature or something.
You know this guy, the Bellard guy who wrote QEMU, he got a big award from SOSP or OSDI
for QEMU
around 3 or 4 years ago.
That's great.
That's the only emulator that I know of.
No, I mean there are others, but I think that's the first one that came with the Binary translation.
And how they work the other ones?
The other ones is I take an instruction, I execute, take instruction, execute. This one takes big chunks of instructions. I mean 100
like
instructions.
Like VMware does.
I guess VMware copy that, right? And then translate to another big block of instructions. So you don't have to go to QEMU for every.
So what happens if I'm doing x86 to x86?
It has to go to the repo.
No, but I think QEMU has there is a feature where you can bypass all that and execute on the machine directly. I mean, the instructions of the VM, you're executing
in
the
case, it's just a virtual.
No, but don't you need the other features that provides? Or, can you use some of the other reporting tools, reporting features that QEMU has?
What kind of features?
I don't know. Besides just executing on a different architecture, it may be doing other things also, right?
Well, I think the feature of that one in translation is that it's much faster than doing instruction per instruction translation.
I understand that, but
okay.
I guess my question is, does QEMU do any sort of reporting at all?
Besides, it has to emulate these drivers and all of that. Even if you don't translate it, QEMU has to do some stuff.
Mm. Why do you guys decide to use QEMU and not a different virtual machine monitor?
Because you need to emulate too.
You tried some different.
I tried. I don't remember the name, but there was a complete machine simulator that some guys implemented with Xen, and I actually was able to run that
every instruction.
Yeah, they simulated everything. I mean, because there are a bunch of simulators that simulate everything, all the buses, or everything that the CPU goes inside, everything, right? So these guys implemented that on top of Xen. And I remember I was able to run that, and then somehow the code got messy. So I was able to get some traces, but it was too slow, and the coding was the code wasn't helping, and yeah, so I stopped.
Also, the QM code is very nice. I don't know what it was.
I don't know if QM code is very nice. I mean, it's very messy.
But we understand it.
Yeah, after a lot of work.
Still work with me, so.
Yeah, I guess my point is that there are not much documentation about that.
And what about how much is low level coding?
In QEMU? I think there is a lot of low level code because it translates to instructions, right? Yeah.
You have a consultant in your apartment.
It's just a jinx, right? It's just a compiler. That's all QM is.
You change your schedule back again.
Yeah, but there were some complications. For instance, for me it was hard to understand the block part. I didn't know how that worked. Then I understood that you have a bunch of instructions in the same block, and then you divide the block in branches. But then there are also cache of blocks. So QEMU, so you need to translate it again. Okay. Then there was this intermediate thing happening. So I don't know which one was intermediate and which one was not. It gets complicated. And the code is huge, and it takes to compile forever. Yeah.
More than the kernel.
Yeah, by far.
You compile it once, and then you only compile the things you changed.
But we changed a very basic header file, which you end up compiling.
Don't change the
dependency. Yeah.
It's like changing the syscall table.
Yeah, the other thing is that I think there are some tricks. I guess I didn't want to learn them, but there are some tricks where you can, because these, when you do make, it compiles everything, all architecture to all architecture, right? So
we did that. We just compiled the architecture.
So the architecture you want, we did that?
Yes, but that's still a lot of time.
Yeah, because there are a lot of shared coding, which is huge.
So do they use an intermediate language?
Yes.
They use
like from one.
Yeah.
That's the general language. I don't remember the name of that.
TCG?
TCG.
Yeah.
Well, TGC,
TCG.
Yeah.
That's what this other tool does. I don't remember the one that translates from C++ to C.
Yeah, LLVM.
So
it has this intermediate language.
That's why you don't need N by N
It's the same thing that you compile.
Is there any book about QEMU?
No, I don't think so.
Best to read code.
No, I prefer to read a book first.
The better documentation is the code.
But it's actually interesting code. But I remember that there are also some wild jumps, because the thing is that from the block you have to jump back to the QEMU code, right? So
that
was you cannot do go to. Because go to is within the same function.
Yes.
Right? And if you go to another function, the compiler will say, okay, I'm not compiling this. There's no way I compile it.
You could use call, right?
No. I mean the instruction. Yeah, but there is a system call that allows you to jump from one function to another.
From the middle of one function to the middle of another.
Exactly. So that's what they do, right? And that's wild. You see that, and you don't know what is happening.
Yeah, but at some point, the difference between that and just calling the function.
You start at the beginning
because,
of the function.
You
need to call versus jump.
No, I mean using a call to call a different function.
Because you start the beginning of the function.
The thing is that you start, the blocks are not functions. The blocks are blocks of code.
That's what I understand.
Right? So,
why at the end of the
so
call?
You jump to there. You don't do a call.
Oh, you mean from QM to the block?
Yeah.
From
the block back.
From the block to QM, you could use just a call function, right?
No, because you want to return to the same point where you left. You leave here, execute, and you want again to be at the point where you left. You don't want to call that function again.
That's a sample code, right?
You don't want to push all the
That's C, actually. Because it's a system call, I think. It's a Unix call.
I mean, what could have been done is that you extracted all those codes out and created functions. And then those would be regular function calls.
Yeah.
But then you create new stacks, right? And where you call.
Yes.
But that's the reason when you're calling a function, you're just pushing some stuff in the stack and jumping. Mm. So they're doing it by hand. Mm. It's just the same.
Yeah, and the other thing is that I think when they developed QMU, they were very concerned about the performance. So they squeezed a lot the performance there. So probably that's part of it.
So that code is an assembly that you need to...
By the way, they means he. Because it's not one guy.
Well, I mean,
is
the whole code...
Role of that?
No. I mean, the...
Now
it's
a lot
huge,
of people.
A huge amount of people. That's what I mean by they.
Hmm. Okay.
So...
Those jump were assembly code that you were reading.
I think... I mean, there are not much... assembly code in the QMU part, I mean jumping to the blocks and going back and so on, but most of the assembly that you have to see is translating these languages.
Yeah.
So that's basically where you see the assembly code. I don't remember the QMU using assembly.
Zero knowledge of,
but that's fine, that's assembly. Fine. I mean, that's learning is not a problem, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's good. So we're starting with literature review, and we have some other ideas. Maybe one of you want to write.
Yeah, I think it's also important we start thinking about possible uses we have for this. I think that's also very important.
But that might change depending on what we find in the literature, right?
That's true. Yeah.
Well, I think we can do that in parallel, finding more applications. The literature review may find additional applications.
Or am I forced to take a different direction?
That is also interesting. For instance, we can look in literature papers that can use something like this.
I think, I mean, people still find interesting patterns and stuff in IO traces, which everybody sees. And this stuff that nobody has seen before, I'm sure we'll have to find something interesting. I mean, we have to find something, otherwise we'll read or something. We have to find something. There has to be something.
Right. Yeah. No, we already found the motivation for the non-blocking rights.
Yes.
Right. So we just now have to prove it, that our analysis with the traces were good and our analysis was good.
Well, what's the finding that a lot of people work without log? Accesses, writing accesses.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of potential for non-blocking there.
I mean, accesses don't have to be unique. I'm sure we'll see something like in some type of application we'll have pages that are mostly read and compared to pages that are mostly reading, or we'll see that, I don't know, DMS pages are, let's say, reading large chunks and writing large chunks. Or I mean, there has to be some pattern. It cannot be nicely uniform across all the systems. There has to be something, and those observations will be, I hope, another.
Something like if probably the code misses too much or...
Yeah.
or if the kernel code misses too much.
And usually systems are just making advantage of taking advantage of those patterns.
Right. How the kernel code would miss memory?
Because it's code, right? I mean,
I guess those pages have some preference.
Yeah, but they're in memory. They're in memory, so...
Oh, you mean...
We should reserve some time to talk about your previous story.
Which one?
Either... Catalyst or...
Which I need it, or when it's tricky.
Yeah, we can set up another time to talk about this. Maybe Tuesday.
Don't content it.
I think so, because we are taking a hiatus from that.
Line
yeah.
Okay. Let's say you want to be duplicating it too. Why not? Right?
Duplicate line.
Yeah. Why it not? Happened and nobody analyzed that before. Even if we don't use it, some interesting, let's say you have a crazy amount of duplication, somebody should be using that for anything.
Yeah.
In-memory loop?
In-memory
in
is done.
Or in caches or whatever. I mean,
but in-memory is people are already doing that, right? Like ESX does that in a different way because it scans the whole memory. Finds pages that are similar.
So you were proposing that as well, right?
But
even
at subcaches, cache low run.
So you actually cache it based on content, I suppose.
Yes. No, but my point with that is that, I mean, there is a lot of information in shells that nobody saw. I mean, just that it opens a huge window for looking at stuff, new stuff.
But that's one of the main reasons why I find it so exciting.
Yeah.
It's good. It's the beginning of something.
Yeah.
You don't know how big it will be.
And something we have to see also is this, right? I mean, connect with OS. There has to be some patterns as well.
Yeah, introspection of OS, what the OS is doing.
Yeah. Right. What are these stores and those? What pages are these? And find out about patterns and patterns of buffer pages or versus CMAs or whatever.
Well, I mean, it's even more general than that. We don't need to do any memory tracing. From QMU, I guess we could monitor state within the OS, inside the OS, without having the OS do anything by itself.
Yeah, it could be even more generic than tracing.
Yeah.
But we, for doing that, you wouldn't need QMU.
You would need it, but if you want to do it without perturbing the OS.
Oh, yeah.
So. But I don't know how that is useful.
What about context switch? Do you know when it's loaded?
Yeah, you know because you are asked to do the context switches. The OS asks you are asked to do the context switches.
Oh, okay, so you know when loaded store stack saves.
Yeah. That's another stat we print. We don't know PID because PID is information from the OS, but if we know that the CR3 changes, we know that the process changes.
So you use the CR3 pointer
to
identify the process?
Kind of, yeah.
You don't really know for sure
if it's a different process.
Right.
Yeah, you don't know what process is. That information up here.
But I mean, the CR3 is...
He's asking you don't know what process.
No. Yeah. It's not working.
That's another information you could get from the web.
Yeah, besides, that same number...
Can be reused,
right?
Yeah, that's it. That's what I was going to ask. That even the same process can have two different CR3s in different files, like if the page was good.
No.
Because the CR3 is a page table. The CR3
that's
is
called gray.
Yeah, but it's a memory.
In gray box, in gray.
Hand farm is about... that was about yeah, now I completely forget. It's from Wisconsin, right?
They yeah, it's on a supervisor level, like they infuse some information from the OS.
Memory related.
Yeah, but they don't actually read it. They just kind of guess.
Mm. Yeah.
We can actually read it. If we show that that's fast enough, we can read and do whatever we want.
But the circuit can change if the page that contains the page table is a bit, or not. That cannot happen.
The R3 doesn't change.
I don't think the page, at least the first level of the page table.
Because virtual memory, right? Even CR3 information is virtual.
Okay. Oh.
CR3 address is virtual.
So how do you translate this?
What do you mean?
Yeah, CR3 is physical. But if that page table moves because some eviction of the page table?
Yeah, I don't think that could happen.
Well, maybe that gets pinned to memory.
Yeah, at least the first level gets pinned.
For every cross?
Possible, yeah.
Okay, so. Somebody not?
No.
If it does get paged out, then CR3 could change, you're right. But I don't know whether that actually happens.
Mm. Yeah, because the page table is the one that says what is out or in.
Yes.
So
you don't have map. You don't have. You are editing the mapping. What mapping are you using to know where you map?
Yeah. Weird. So in that case, there are a lot of pages being to memory.
Mm.
Yeah.
Unless there is a page table to page table.
Yeah.
Or some kind of mapping.
Alright guys, so let's meet in a week or 2 weeks, depending on how the literature review goes. And you guys can decide when we should meet. And this time it seems to be good for all of us.
True. One unrelated question. Are we meeting for software?
Well, I think we've decided to take a break from SoftPM, right?
So.